Yep. If you're coming back for more, just like Hemingway,
you haven't had
more
enough
in World War II. What was his drink? What was his drink
Papa
called?
Papa Doble. Yeah, the Papa Double.
We're topping off your Papa Doble right now.
Oh yeah, you're just that bartender knows you by name. Yeah. You walk through the door, he starts pouring. Everybody's feeling it. You're king of the world, but you can't get your shit together.
No.
This is a guy who never got his shit together outside of the writing.
Yep.
Yeah. Not really. And yeah. what an extravagant life to cover. I think we burnt Aaron Gwynn's MacBook out.
Probably.
He may not be here. Certainly, we love Aaron Gwynn.
Of course, he is a rock star
and a killer. We're going to have him back for more Art of Darkness. It sounds like he committed. He committed on a core episode too.
Yeah,
to do the Blood Meridian special at the end of the year. So it's
we'll get him for that.
Awesome.
We'll get him
for that. And he's got to come on for the book club meeting for his own book.
Well, that's true too. I mean, yeah, we didn't even talk about that, but yeah, I'm sure he'll be down for that.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's coming. We love Aaron, but I'm going to cover his NKVD. Maybe he pops up. It's all good.
Okay.
What a hoot! What fun! Well, let's start with Hunter S. Thompson.
Okay, I love it.
Let's just read a few paras there. Well, first, Brad, what the hell? What? That was 5.5 hours. What did you make of that?
Yeah.
It's
interesting, man, because I knew the vague outlines of his life. You know, I knew suicide. Like I said in the episode, I've gone to the memorial, his memorial in Sun Valley, near Sun Valley. I read quite a bit of his work, not everything. And you know, I knew the general outlines. I didn't know how much involvement. I didn't know he had so much involvement in World War II. I guess I don't know how I missed that. So that was interesting. It was really, you know. And I have not to talk too much about my own work, but I have a challenging relationship with the sort of I have a style of writing that's a little bit. I don't even know how to describe it without. I'm going to give it positive adjectives, but I describe it. It's not
florid.
Hemingway.
It's florid. Florid.
Right. At times.
And that cuts both ways.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. Right. So, and I'm aware that that's got its pros and cons to it. So for Hemingway to me has always been.
It's all pros, Brad.
So I've always been sort of, Hemingway's sort of always been in my orbit as a sort of like, okay, but it's not. I don't think he's wrong. I just think there's other ways to do it, I guess. So he's always kind of an interesting figure for me, but you can still learn a lot from him. I learned a lot from his book, Ernest Hemingway on Writing. It's just little aphorisms and bits from letters and things. And you can learn a ton. Like if you're, you know, want to get into writing and are interested in it, pick up that book. It is one of the best books on writing. Yeah.
He was a very disciplined writer. And that's the other thing.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot from him before this episode about you go to the desk every day. You know, you chip away at it. You don't cut corners. Like when you said 47 times to rewrite the ending of Farewell to Arms, I was like, yeah, that's what it might take. Might not take 47, but it takes a lot of them. Right. So it was fascinating. So it was really interesting to get his whole story. And like I said, I'm chin deep in David Foster Wallace research, and it's like I'm going to say some of the same exact things next week when we do David Foster Wallace. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I dealing with Hemingway, I can never get over the monstrousness and the pity. There's a period where you start to feel just real pity. He was a difficult character, and I think that generation, literary people who really cared, really did. Like when these bios came out, it was like, whoa, he got electroshocked. Like he was locked up against his will. I mean, you almost just can't think of a more ignominious way to go. I mean, Mary herself says maybe we should have just let him kill himself.
Well, there is a thing where for certain people, it hits a point of pain where it's like, what are we doing here?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's and that's a hard conversation to even think about, but.
Well, he went out too far.
Yeah, he did.
So let's hear from another great literary suicide who modeled himself after Papa. And this is Hunter in the National Observer in 1964, the great Hunter S. Thompson. I'll read until it feels like I should stop. We're going to cover three or four fun things on After Dark for our Patreon subscribers.
Yeah, thank you guys
so much. Your support means a lot. Every time we get a new subscriber, it gets us all jacked up. And we genuinely appreciate it. We hope you're enjoying what we do. Ketchum, Idaho. That poor old man, he used to walk out there on the road in the evenings. He was so frail and thin and old looking that it was embarrassing to see him. I was always afraid a car would hit him. And that would have been an awful way for him to go. I was tempted to go out and tell him to be careful. And I would have if it had been anyone else. But with Hemingway, it was different. The neighbor shrugged and glanced at Ernest Hemingway's empty house. A comfortable-looking chalet with a pair of elk horns over the front door. It is built on a hillside looking down in the Big Wood River and out across the valley at the Sawtooth Mountains. A mile or so away, in a small graveyard at the north end of town, is Hemingway's simple grave, lying in the afternoon shadow of Baldy Mountain and the Sun Valley ski runs. Beyond Baldy are the high pastures of the Wood River National Forest, where thousands of sheep graze in the summer, tended by Basque shepherds from the Pyrenees. All winter long, the grave is covered with deep snow, but in the summer, tourists come out and take pictures of each other standing beside it. Last summer, there was a problem with people taking chunks of earth for souvenirs. When news of his death made headlines in 1961, there must have been other people beside myself who were not as surprised by the suicide as by the fact that the story was datelined Ketchum, Idaho. What was he doing living there? When had he left Cuba, where most people assumed he was working, against what he knew what was his last deadline on the long-promised big novel? The newspapers never answered those questions, not for me at any rate. So it was with a heavy feeling of long, restless curiosity that I came last week up the long, bleak road to Ketchum, over the drainage divide between the Magic and the Wood River valleys, through Shoshone and Bellevue and Haley, Ezra Pound's hometown, past Jack's Rock Shop on US 93 and into Ketchum itself, population 783. Anybody who considers himself a writer or even a serious reader cannot help but wonder just what it was about this outback little Idaho village that struck such a responsive chord in America's most famous writer. He had been coming here off and on since 1938 until finally in 1960 he bought a home just outside of town, and not incidentally, a 10-minute drive from Sun Valley, which is so much a part of Ketchum that they are really one and the same. The answers might be instructive, not only as a key to Hemingway, but to a question he often pondered, even in print. We do not have great writers, he explains to the Austrian in Green Hills of Africa. Something happens to our good writers at a certain age. You see, we make our writers into something very strange. We destroy them in many ways. But Hemingway himself never seemed to discover in what way he was being destroyed, and so he never understood how to avoid it. Even so, he knew something had gone wrong with both himself and his writing. And after a few days in Ketchum, you get a feeling that he came here for exactly that reason, because it was here in the years just before and after World War II that he came to hunt and ski and raise hell in the local pubs with Gary Cooper and Robert Taylor and all the other celebrities who came to Sun Valley when it still loomed large on Cafe Society's maps of diversion. Those were the good years with Hemingway, and Hemingway never got over the fact that they couldn't last. He was here with his third wife in 47, Gellhorn, but then he settled in Cuba and 12 years went by before he came again, a different man this time, with yet another wife, Mary, and a different view of the world he had once been able to see clear and as a whole. Ketchum was perhaps the only place in his world that had not changed radically since the good years. Europe had been completely transformed. Africa was in the process of drastic upheaval. And finally, even Cuba blew up around him like a volcano. Castro's educators taught the people that Mr. Way had been exploiting them, and he was in no mood in his old age to live with any more hostility than was necessary. Only Ketchum seemed unchanged, and it was here that he decided to dig in. That's a point that I didn't make on the core episode, but that loss of Cuba was absolutely devastating to him. Yeah. He lost the sunshine. He lost a respite, like a refuge in the finca. He lost his books. He lost his stuff. You know, and as I age personally, like the idea of moving house again, like I'm going to do it. I have personal reasons I have to do it. But like if somebody told me, Kevin, hey, Fidel Jr., Justin Trudeau, just kidding. But you know, that's about, okay. Justin Trudeau has annexed the Twin Cities, and mm-hmm. you have to leave. Like that'd be devastating. Yeah, that's not right. Good. I mean, like, and much that. Less if you were like 55, 60. Oh, and by the way, they're keeping your house,
right?
And like right. all your stuff. I mean, it would be terrible. I mean, yeah. Hemingway moved. They left Cuba almost like refugees.
Yeah. I mean. Yeah, that's intense. I understand wanting to move to Ketchum, though. I've been there. I love it. It's gorgeous. I remember one of the first times I was ever out there, when it was snowing, or when the snow had fallen, and pulling off to the side of the road, probably the same road he's talking about, but further north, pulling over to the side of the road and just looking out and just being like, yeah, there's you don't want to leave here. Like it's just so, if you're it appeals to a particular kind of landscape. I'm a mountain person, like people are beach people or ocean people or desert people. I'm a mountain person. That's just the thing that speaks to me. And it's gorgeous up there, man. It's painfully pretty at times. We're just like, ugh. Sawtooth Mountains are one of the most beautiful places in the country. They're right there. And, you know, it's still a celebrity hotspot. I mean, times I went up there, I saw Tom Hanks at a coffee shop. I saw, I can't remember the name of the actor. He's passed now, but he's one of the villains in the first RoboCop movie.
Oh, yeah.
I've seen like two major actors and like four or five that you're like, I recognize kind of that guy.
Kind of a known, but maybe not known kind of a vibe. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. And I remember driving up there once with a friend's cousin who lived up there all the time, going by the little Ketchum airport, and there's a big plane had just landed. He's like, yeah, that's Schwarzenegger's plane.
There you go.
Sure. Yeah, so it's like it's a thing.
Do they have like fine dining? And I mean, is it money? Yeah,
okay. Yeah. It's small. And I remember I went to a bar hanging out and talking to this girl, not even flirtatious, but you know, just talking to this girl that was there, and somebody else that I knew said, you know, that's the heiress to the DuPont fortune. So this woman's worth like $9 billion.
Sure.
And she's having like a Miller Lite at this, you know, at a normal bar. Yeah.
And how did you fumble that bag?
Don't ask.
This went After Dark's for Brad. Oh my God. We wouldn't even, and we love our Patreons. We wouldn't, I mean, imagine if we had DuPont money.
Right.
Things that could have been.
Yeah. That's all right.
Well,
so anyway, cool not story. To distract too much, but I love Ketchum. I went to see his memorial. I love that part of the country, man.
Okay. Very good. Well, and that was fun to read from Hunter, who, of course, very heavily modeled himself on Hemingway, as did so many writers. But Hunter went so far as to like type out Hemingway and type out Fitzgerald and type out, I think, Twain and Faulkner to get him into his fingers. Worked. And I mean, when he's writing that story, you can tell he's very clearly paying homage to a certain style as he's writing, consciously doing it. Here's a little bit about the twisted gender stuff.
Yeah.
So
this is all new to me. Like I didn't know anything about any of this. I had never even heard of this Garden of Eden book, or what is it called?
Yeah, the Garden of Eden.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which he wrote in the 40s, but was not published until 86. And of course, this comes from Salon. And a lot of this was, well, this article seems to have been inspired by the fact that they touch on this in the Burns documentary. So the series, the Burns series, also hints at an altogether different side to the great writer. From a contemporary perspective, it becomes clear that he spent a lifetime grappling with a carefully concealed anxiety regarding gender identity. As Hemingway explains, the world saw him as a man's man, but all his life he would privately be intrigued by the blurred lines between male and female, men and women. The Garden of Eden. I first became aware, and the author of this is Nick Hilden. All right. I first became aware of this unexpected twist in the Hemingway narrative upon my arrival in Paris. While browsing Shakespeare and Company, I encountered the only of his titles with which I was unfamiliar, The Garden of Eden. The book revolutionized my conception of the author. According to Burns and Novick, in the documentary, Hemingway himself called the book too sexually adventurous to be published during his lifetime. The edited version that was published posthumously represents a small portion of a much larger opus that the writer struggled to complete over the course of his last 15 years. The book follows the newly married David and Catherine Bourne as they honeymoon along the French Riviera. Everything seems typically Hemingway, a writer protagonist, plenty of fishing, fine food and wine, allusions to war. When Catherine takes a sharp turn into gender switching, "I'm going to be changed," she informs her husband before cutting her hair short as a boy's. "I'm a girl, but now I'm a boy too, and I can do anything and anything and anything," she teases or warns. "I'm going to wake up in the night and do something to you that you've never even heard of or imagined." A few pages later, our Hemingway avatar, David, experiences the strangeness inside as Catherine penetrates him.
Whoa.
From there, woo!
Yeah, what?
Okay, what? Yeah. From there, the gender roles continue to evolve as Catherine, then eventually David, falls in love with another woman. Catherine has all three of them cut their hair into matching schoolboy styles, and she and her husband dye their hair the same blonde. "You are changing," she tells him. "Yes, you are, and you're my girl, Catherine. Will you change and be my girl and let me take you?" As it turns out, these were not idle fantasies. According to the documentary, and this is pretty, they wouldn't put it in, that Burns is too good. This is pretty confirmed. Yeah, Hemingway's fourth wife, Mary Welsh, cut her hair short and dyed it platinum at his request. And she did call him, I think, a name like Catherine or something like that. And he called her something else. Yeah.
Huh.
Hemingway biographer Mary Dearborn elaborates, he really had a thing about androgyny and liked to switch sex roles in bed. And he tells Mary, "Let's play around. I'll call you Pete and you call me Catherine." And Pete. Yeah, Pete. She's
Pete's satisfying. Not a very sexy name. I don't know what names are sexy, but
shout out to all the Petes out there.
It's sexually neutral, as I feel. But yeah, maybe I'm wrong.
Well, so she satisfied him in this desire, and it took a lot of guts for him. And in a way, he wanted to be a woman who loved another woman, right? And this, I'm quoting this Mary Dearborn. As the writer himself says, via androgynous Catherine in the Garden of Eden, "Why do we have to go by everyone else's rules? We're us." Maybe Hemingway isn't quite what we expected. And you could see why he would...
Major persona he has to maintain, right? I mean,
oh, people would have thought that he had lost his mind.
Yeah. It's surprising he even wrote it, really, in a way. Like, what were
I think
you...
he, I think he was getting off, frankly.
Could be.
I think he was enjoying himself because he would do the same thing. He had he wrote the Garden of Eden. I get these two confused. Across the River and Into the Trees.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, that was basically just like a fantasy about Adriana.
Creepy old erotic fantasy. Yeah. So, but more acceptable.
Yeah, I mean, whatever, but it is surprising. Yeah, I did not see that coming at all. Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a turn of the screw for Hemingway, for sure.
Yeah.
All right, I got two more things for After Dark, and I found some links. I know Gwyn had something to say about this. Maybe we'll ask him when we have him back on the pod. But I did find from history.com, someone named Reynolds, I think a biographer, looked into it. He found evidence suggesting that Hemingway had, in fact, been involved in work for the OSS, the precursor to the CIA, as well as other U.S. agencies, including the FBI, the State Department, and the Office of Naval Intelligence. But in a stunning twist, he also found evidence that beginning in late 1940, Hemingway may have spied for another organization, the People's Commissariat for Internal Affairs, NKVD, which was the predecessor of the KGB.
Wow.
The revelation that one of his literary heroes may have spied for Stalin hit Reynolds hard. I felt like I had taken an elbow deep in the gut when I read he had signed on with the NKVD. He writes in the introduction to this book.
What the hell?
As Reynolds recounts, Hemingway wasn't particularly political until the Spanish Civil War broke out. While reporting on the conflict for the American Newspaper Alliance, Hemingway became passionately devoted to the anti-fascist cause and even joined the Republican guerrillas fighting Franco's nationalist forces. He would later draw on the experience when writing For Whom the Bell Tolls. All right. His experience in Spain plunged Hemingway into the world of the revolutionary left and brought him to the attention of the Soviets. The Soviet Union was the only foreign power to provide real support to the Spanish rebels, while Nazi Germany and fascist Italy backed Franco. There was also some tension. Pauline was a Catholic.
One thing I want to point. We're not talking at this point anyway. We're not talking about Cold War spying.
No. We're talking about the 40s.
So you know, if you did some spy work that helped the Russians during World War II, you're still on the American side, kind of potentially. It's not betraying your country necessarily.
No. Yeah. And the truth about the Soviet Union wasn't really revealed until the Gulag Archipelago came out.
Right.
So
Yeah, we're not talking about handing over nuclear secrets in the 60s.
Right. And that's good context for people. Yeah. For sure. Yeah. Yeah. But it's still kind of gutting. It's still
weird.
Wait a minute. In a 2009 book written by an estranged former KGB officer, there are no former KGB officers.
Right.
There are no former Art of Darkness listeners. Once you're in, you're in. Alexander Vasiliev, Reynolds found verbatim excerpts from Ernest Hemingway's official Soviet file that Vasiliev had smuggled out of Russia. The excerpts showed that around December 1940, NKVD agents had recruited Hemingway for our work on ideological grounds. Though it was unclear what exactly they wanted from Hemingway, his influence and access, as well as his talent as a propagandist, would have made him a potentially valuable intelligence asset. According to the smuggled files, Jacob Golos, a top agent in the NKVD office in New York, was the one who met with Hemingway, who received the codename Argo. The deal got sealed here in New York, somewhere in the Lower East Side. We don't know exactly, Reynolds told CBS News. Although Hemingway apparently met several times with the Soviets during the 1940s, so he may have ultimately done little to help them. As Reynolds sees it, he seems to have been motivated more by his opposition to fascism than any particular allegiance to communism, and likely regretted entering into the arrangement as more time passed.
Yeah.
He was also involved with U.S. intelligence. He participated in several missions for the OSS. For one of them, he set out to chase German U-boats in the Caribbean. We talked about that. While the U.S. and USSR were on the same side in World War II, things changed after the war ended. And so his ties with the Soviet intelligence would come to haunt him because it was like, oh, no. As Reynolds sees it, Hemingway's involvement with the NKVD influenced many of the decisions he made during his last 15 years, where he lived, what he wrote, and how he acted. So,
I mean, that's what he's scared about. That's what he's. So the FBI thing is that because they would know. I'm sure they knew that.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
very curious. The plot thickens. There's a play or two in this alone. If we were going to talk about this, I think the way to handle Hemingway would be like almost like a 3-season HBO or like a 10-part HBO thing. And I don't know where you focus on. I think you would have to focus on a certain part of his life. You could do a biopic that could be incredible. Maybe look at like the Cash biopic and how that worked. But just the thing of Hemingway was so big and there's no music. I mean, the writing is the music. So I just don't know how you would grab, you know.
Yeah, it's hard to dramatize writing.
Yeah, the act.
It really is.
Yeah. I mean, you could do it through metaphor. You could do like a 5-part series where, it could be boxing in Paris. It could be bullfighting in Spain. Yeah. It could be hunting in Idaho or maybe like fishing that'd be a way to do it structurally. This could be a play too. You could do it across those 5 things. What would it be like? What would the 5 things be? This is fun. I'm just ideating this as I go. I've already written my Hemingway play. Yeah. Maybe one day I'll revisit it because I need a central metaphor. No, you have Paris, boxing. You could have, like I said, Spain in the bullfights.
Right.
You could have the deep sea fishing and
in Cuba
and Key West. Yeah. You could have hunting in the American West, like in Ketchum.
Well, and then you can do that. You can tie that in with the childhood hunting in northern Michigan, right? There's some way to kind of bookend those.
I think part five, the fifth part, you know what it is?
Electroshock.
Women.
Ah, yeah. Yeah.
That'd be an interesting way to approach a biopic or like a series about Hemingway.
Yeah, it was interesting. That note of like he needed a new wife for every book sort of thing. That's an interesting...
Yeah.
That's just an interesting note. And it's probably, there's probably some kernel of truth to that, right? It's like every book is a new thing.
It's a new love.
You know, he spent a lot of time, it's a new life. He spent, you know, big chunks of time in totally radically different places, right? So, mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting.
Well, I'm on to the last piece. And I would really encourage everybody go and find this. The journalist is named John Rosengren. If you've listened this long, you know that this is the fellow who heard about Hemingway at the Mayo through a little thing that I did. And then he really went hard. He went down to Rochester. He tells a story on our sister podcast, on the Bad Mouth Theater Company podcast, Mouthing Off, which Brad was just on, and you might check out. Mm-hmm. That's at badmouthtc.com. Brad does some tarot reading, ad hoc reading. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
John was our guest prior. And on that, he talks about how he had one of these serendipitous moments happen when he was down at the Mayo. He was down at Rochester, like 70 minutes south of here. Mm. And somebody was walking him around town. They popped into like a pharmacist. They asked the pharmacist about Hemingway, and the pharmacist said, well, didn't he spend time up the hill at that house? Oh, the one with the pool? Yeah, the one with the pool. Yeah, I think he had spent some time there. Well, and his guide was like, oh, I know the people who live there. Let's go check it out. And so they go up and they find he finds two of the last known photos of Ernest Hemingway.
That's crazy.
They
were 60 years old.
Yeah, they were going to be, they're in the scrapbooks.
Yeah.
And they were going to be included in this Minneapolis St. Paul magazine. It's mspmag.com. It's called The Last Days of Hemingway at Mayo Clinic. Came out in 2019. You can look this up, and you really should. If you're interested in this, it's really, really fascinating. But at the last minute, they pulled it. But what John told me on the Mouthing Off podcast, and which I'll relate now, is that in one picture, he looks so old and frail. He looks more like 80 than 60.
Yeah.
And he's at the pool, and you can see, you know, everything. And then in the other one, he looks so happy. And apparently he would do like a trick, which John kind of found sad. He would do a trick where he would like make his stomach firm and let the little girls punch him in the stomach.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a certain quality of like, bro, can you just kind of almost like grow up, or you know, do you think you're being avuncular, or you realize you're here because you're like,
falling apart. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just this weird. That's how he recounted it. And he said the second image, you can't believe that that guy would blow his brains out. But here's a little bit of John.
The ECT stuff is weird, man. We're going to talk more about it in the David Foster Wallace episode, because David Foster Wallace had ECT as well. And after one of them, and I'm not going to give away too much, but after one of them, when he came out of it, his mother described him as being delicate as a child. And there's just something about like your nervous breakdown, depression, and then you get this thing and you just come out of it and you're just like,
Yeah.
And it's scary. Like it worked, right? But like, holy smokes, what went out the door with that? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just going to read a little bit about how familiar the doctors were with him. And his two doctors were named Dr. Rome and Dr. Butt.
Okay.
Dr. Butt.
Yeah.
It's a real doctor name. Even by the standards of the time, which were more lenient than today's, it was unusual for doctors to grant a patient with an enlarged liver and a long history of daily drinking license to consume alcohol. It was stranger to put a gun in the hands of a depressed patient who had intended to shoot himself. Hemingway, a Nobel laureate, engaged both Rome and Butt on various occasions in discussions about literature, an uncommon privilege for doctors who likely spent most of their time on more routine patient care. Hemingway's charisma, even in his depressed state, may also have compromised their professional judgment. According to Anthony J. Bianco III, a writer who is working on the history of the Mayo Clinic, they were enamored of his celebrity and his talent, he told me. He sort of bewitched them. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the intimacy of the relationship gave Hemingway's doctors insights about their patient. Aware of Hemingway's extroverted nature, Rome charged Bob Reinerson, one of the young residents, to socialize with the writer. And I believe this is the house, this is, might have been Reinerson's house he ended up with, or at, where the pictures were. Bob was the son of Edward Reinerson, an endocrinologist at Mayo. And Mayo is a company town. Rochester is a company town. It's the Mayo. Yeah, it's Rochester. All Mayo. It's like literally all Mayo. There's really no other place quite like it.
Yeah, we talked about it a bit on the Norm Macdonald episode, actually.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Edward Reinerson was a collector of Hemingway first editions. The younger Reinerson invited Hemingway to Sunday brunch at his parents' Cape Cod style house in the Sunny Slopes neighborhood where deer roamed the lawns. Their house featured Rochester's first in-ground swimming pool surrounded by a white fence and grapevines. You get to use that pool 4 months out of the year.
Yeah.
they told us to treat him like family, but I thought there is no way he is like one of us. Bob's wife, Margie. Margie. Oh, hey, Margie.
Old Papa Hemingway,
She avoided him at first, busying herself with brunch preparations in the kitchen. It made me anxious to think we had a famous person down by the pool. Mm. That spring, Hemingway became a regular at the Reinerson's table and pool, making the mile and a half walk from St. Mary's, which is one of the hospitals at Mayo. It's a big complex of different, with Bob's sister Anne, a recreational therapist. He enjoyed splashing in the pool with the children and then telling them stories about the war. He shadowboxed poolside with Bob and, according to family lore, cut his knuckle on Bob's tooth. And then Margie relented. She said he was part of the family. He was just kind of magical. And she would prepare his favorite meal, green turtle steak. Bob had the meat flown in from Florida. The night of the dinner, Hemingway arrived early and asked if he could do something useful outside. Bob suggested he mow the lawn. A short time later, a neighbor stopped by to fetch a loaf of bread from the communal freezer in the Reinerson's garage. Ah, Minnesota.
Yeah.
She returned home to report the Reinersons have a gardener who looks exactly like Ernest Hemingway.
that's awesome.
that's a really nice story, light note. Write drunk, edit sober. Maybe don't write drunk at all if it gets too out of hand.
Yeah.
Kill your darlings. Be good to each other. Don't think that success is any kind of palliative to your demons.
And it doesn't
always
give you,
remember,
it doesn't give you a license to do anything that nobody else can do. You know what I mean? Exactly. You still got to be decent.
Love your kids. Mm-hmm. Be a decent human being. Use your power if you achieve that kind of power for good, whatever that means to you. Yeah. And if your friend comes to you and he's paranoid, thinking like a three-letter agency is after him, listen to him.
Yeah, he's right. His chances are he's right.
Maybe, or maybe not, but
he might not be.
Don't write it off.
It's not ridiculous. Yeah.
Brad, thank you so much for being my partner in this. This is a lot of fun, man. I really enjoyed it. We hope you enjoyed listening to, I think almost 6 hours on Hemingway.
Yeah, man. Hell of a presentation.
Very grateful for your support.
Yeah, this is one for the books, and this is fun. Yeah, we got more coming. If you listen to this still, we got a whole lot coming. So
you know who I'm doing next?
Yeah, who are you doing next?
Marilyn Monroe.
Ooh, who? No, that's gonna be a banger. That'll be interesting. All right.
Peace. Good night.